All right. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Soule with the Brothers Wisp again, coming back on schedule. Look at this. Was this 2 weeks in a row? This is magical. So with us today, we've got Justin Miller out of Virginia up there. We've got Mike Hammett out of Chicago. And we got Thomas Kernak out of Slovakia, middle of the night, like always. He's a trooper. So today we're going to talk quickly about, well, I guess less talk about and more beat the dead horse of the UBNT, the Ubiquity exploit that happened just recently, and then talk about a few ways that people can commonly protect their networks. Whether we all do them or not is neither here nor there, but you know, there are some best practices that we can probably all follow. So I would say the largest troll as far as this Ubiquity exploit goes is Mike Hammett. So he's our subject matter expert on this one because he did more complaining than anybody else. So he should really know his stuff, right? Because if you're going to complain about it, you better have all of your information together. So I guess give us the quick and dirty on it, Mike.
Well, the exploit affected several Ubiquity products. It affected legacy devices, like the old like the pre-Air Max devices. It affected the Air Max M devices that everyone's using, the Air Max AC devices, tough switches, air gateways, air fibers. That might be all of them, because they all used the same management interface. So, of course, when they have the same management interface, they're subject to the same exploit potential, which was an HTTP/HTTPS vulnerability that permitted an outside unauthenticated user to upload files onto the device in a location where the device would execute those, and then at that point it's open to whatever they wanted to do. They patched this back in July of 2015. For the Air Max M series, there would have been update 5.5.10, update 2, 5.5.11, and 5.6.2 were all the first ones with this patch. And I can't remember the versions for all the other ones, but they were all patched as well. And essentially, what would happen is that when you got to this point in the firmware, they could still upload files to the device, which seems not good, but it wouldn't execute them, which is good. What was happening is that people hadn't patched their devices, or they hadn't properly firewalled them from sources of infestation. And it was a worm. You know, the attackers fired it off, and it would scan, I believe, seemingly random subnets on the internet looking for Ubiquity devices. And if it would infect them, it would upload. Well, there's two different types of exploits actually happening at the same time. But the ones that were the most prevalent, I believe, uploaded an mf.tar file, which it would then extract. It would change the login credentials for the device at some point to username, mother, password of effer, but the complete word. And people noticed the bug because there was a warning on the page, on the web page when they logged into the radio, saying something about unauthorized scripts present. Or they couldn't log into the radio with their credentials. But this would run for, and it would do different things at different times. I don't know the details. I didn't completely dig through everything that it did and when it did it. But at 66,666 seconds, which is just about 18 and a half hours, it would reset the radio to default, which is what was getting everybody.
So weren't there a couple of variants? One would sort of lock you out and just give remote access to somebody, and then the other one would reset to factory default, or is it all in one? It would just lock you out and then eventually just reset it to factory default.
There were two different payloads that Ubiquity confirmed that were delivered. I did get it on four radios, so I can tell you what was on mine. And mine seems to be what the most prevalent payload was. What the other one had, I'm not completely certain.
That's interesting. But to get exploited, right, you had to have a public IP or a private IP that had a NATed address coming straight in. So it's basically they had to have direct internet access to the Ubiquity device, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, something had to get to it. And it is possible that you could have got infected from the other side, like an air router on the inside, on the inside of your, like say your CPE is just a bridge with no public IPs, but there's an air router behind it that did. If they had a common subnet, you could still get infected.
Gotcha. Because, I mean, that was one of the things these routers would try and do. Once they got infected, they would hunt and try and spread it out to everybody else, right?
Right, right.
Okay. So, immediately, it was nearly a year ago that the fix was released, right? So, it was just the slackers that weren't updating firmware that got hit. Is that right?
Right, yeah. And there was lots of, and then there's not just the, WISPs, but you have lots of people buying these things for, private businesses where they don't have an IT person that would even know about updating firmware. Obviously it hurts WISPs the most because, I heard many stories of 3,000 plus subscribers getting factory defaulted and spending weeks. I mean, they're probably still reconfiguring people.
Yeah, that's insane. And, it was, and even after the big attack really happened and people started getting rolled, to factory default, there were still WISPs 2 weeks later getting hit that didn't patch any of this stuff, right?
Oh, right. Yeah. It happened initially on like a Thursday or Friday of the 1 week. I forget how many weeks ago it was now. So that then on that Friday or into that Saturday is when some people started to report it because it was 18 hours later and they started losing their devices. But that weekend constituted the bulk of the panic. Fast forward 10 days, 2 weeks, and we're still getting reports of people getting freshly infected. People that had no idea of the problem existed. And 2 weeks after this was announced, they still had thousands of radios getting, kicked off the air.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know this was a big security vulnerability, but, honestly, until people started getting infected, I hadn't caught wind that there was this big exploit that was known and kind of, I guess, published to the community in any way. But honestly, anybody who's worked with Ubiquiti or MikroTik or any of the major manufacturers, when you find a firmware version that works, you tend to stick with it for a while until you can test another known good. So it's not like I can blame these folks, right? My environment's working, it's stable, so I don't want to just start willy-nilly rolling up to new firmware versions. So I can't blanket blame those guys. I guess one of the big main fixes was to block external access to port 80 and port 443 from outside, right?
You could also block. There was one site where it would download two different binaries, wget and something else, and that was the open WRT site, WRT. And once you blocked that, it would also not be able to spread very effectively.
Gotcha. So. But honestly, that only stops these first variants, right? So as soon as people start churning out new versions of this, it's just going to...
Yeah.
So really, the only real fix would be to block 80 and 443 from outside resources coming in. And honestly, how many of you guys do that on your network? I'm assuming most of you guys do, right? Other than Mike, who left a couple devices open.
Yet, on those devices, I would like to, obviously ultimately the blame falls on me because it's my network, but I would like to blame Ubiquiti for that. they were on subnets with other devices that were picked up in UCRM, but UCRM never discovered these devices. So when I did, upgrade this sector to this version, those radios are missed because UCRM never found them, despite having open IPs and the same credentials as everything else. They never discovered it. They couldn't so I didn't know to upgrade those firmwares. It wasn't until I developed, I took a script and then stole it and made it better. They actually scanned my entire network that I found these devices.
Gotcha. Yeah, so just as a best practice on most of our equipment that's going to get a public IP, sort of on a customer side that's not like a data center customer, that's one of the things we do is we block kind of those standard well-known ports. If these guys are clever and they really need a service open, they can use a non-standard port to change their devices too, right? And so I guess that would probably squash this bug if you're running on a non-standard port. I'm sure it's not looking for non-standard ports. What's what's something you guys did? So Mike, you got immediately hit, was blocking ADM 443 from outside. Was that something you implemented, or did you just upgrade all of your gear?
I just upgraded. I've got other stuff to do.
So you trust your users enough?
Well, I actually did get started with, I started rolling out, because my scan that I did of the whole network was built in Ansible. And those that don't know Ansible is just kind of an automation tool. There's a few of them, Puppet, Chef, I believe they all do very similar things. For all that stuff, we would go to Tomas for being the authority in that. But I basically just took something somebody else put up there and said, hey, I made this script in Ansible that cleans it. Well, I took it and said, well, no, you missed this part, you missed this part, you missed this part. I put it together, made a guide showing people how to install the whole, you know, from a bare VM all the way up to executing this package, which I think is what made it so popular at that point, is I showed you how to use it. By the time Ubiquiti came out with their own scanning tools, which people loved, but their scanning tools will only do one thing, whereas I started the Ansible process of you can use it for anything. So my next step was, let's take one of my devices that's just a dummy AP sitting there for testing, through the GUI, let's go ahead and add all the firewalls we should have on the radio. You know, accept ADM 443 from this management network. Accept it from this management network, and then deny all others. I started to build that in the GUI so I could look at the backend config to see how it constructed it, so I could then put that into an Ansible script to roll out network-wide. I didn't finish by the end of that day, and, well, I haven't gone back since.
That's cool. If you put up the guide, have you made it available publicly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was the first usable guide on the Ubiquiti forum. Their guide's actually linked to it until they made their own tool.
Very cool.
Saying, if you want to clear it, go look at this.
Very nice. Okay.
And it, you know, it did different things differently, but, you know, they made one on an Android phone. They made one in Java.
Gotcha. So I guess all in all, these aren't uncommon events, right? This has happened to major manufacturers many times over. Lessons learned, right? So whenever an event happens, we do what we call a postmortem. We go back and look, what could we have done different? What we could have done better? From a Ubiquiti perspective, I thought getting the word out a little bit quicker would have been better. To me, I was thinking if you'd ever send an email to them, you know, via support or anything like that, or you're registered in the forums, they should just dump you an email saying, hey, we had this exploit. And in fact, I actually got an email eventually. I'm not sure where they pulled my email address from, but one of those. But I thought as soon as they knew there was some kind of infection rolling out and then there was anything you could do, I think that would have been the time for them to reach out and communicate a little bit quicker. That would have been probably, what, 3 or 4 days before they actually sent out the email. I mean, other than place things in the forum, how can you imagine they could have gotten the word out a little bit better or done anything different or better?
Well, they did make a blog post, and you can subscribe to the blog post, which I do, which they use those pretty much to notify you of security problems, of new firmware releases. You know, I think people need to take advantage of that more. They did do that the first day. Then a day or two later, yeah, you know, then they pushed out that email to their newsletter list talking about this. It was still the weekend, and then it wasn't until like 2 or 3 days into the next week where then I started getting that notice from their distributors. You know, their distributors' newsletters started mentioning it. And this is all things that should have happened Friday afternoon, you know, before I even knew it was a problem. They knew it was a problem at that point. I didn't. But some people weren't notified until Wednesday.
So of everything, do you think it was just community notification that was, in your mind, something they could have done differently that would have been better? Is that the only thing?
No, you can only go take people so far. I mean, they did a couple things. They could have done a few more things. But I mean, I saw on a lot of, like, on some of the mailing lists of number of operators that hadn't checked their email since Friday, so they wouldn't have even known. You know, they could send out 1,000 emails and they wouldn't know until they get back to work on Monday and, oh my God, my network's broken. And Ubiquiti can't do anything about that. You know, there was some talks about, you know, they should make it an option that they auto upgrade by default, and the operator disables it if they don't want the auto upgrade. So that way, then, you know, prosumers that don't pay attention get the upgrades, but then, you know, people didn't like that. There's lots of back and forth about ways that they could proactively change it on their own, but ultimately it was...
To me, that sounds like a recipe for disaster, right? Say you've got 60 people hanging off of a sector, and then that sector upgrades, and then none of those clients can connect, right? You know, if the clients upgraded first, yeah, that would have been okay, but in this instance, it didn't happen. So that's asking for trouble. So let's talk about best practices. One is inbound, I block 80 and 443, and I block FTP, you know, going to like MDU users and things like that. I also, on those MikroTiks, run a firewall script that looks for people port scanning and trying to, you know, shenanigans. You're looking for shenanigans and you're just trying to mitigate those out, right? So you add those IP addresses to address lists and give them a little timeout so you don't block them forever. And then you just kind of squash that activity. What's other? So I know Thomas doesn't run any Ubiquity in his network. Not that he necessarily hates it. It's just from what my understanding is, that's not as feature rich and production ready. There's no CLI. I think that sticks in his craw more than anything. And probably the inability to SNMP poll things accurately is probably troublesome. So what do you do that's kind of a default on your networks for kind of a best practice to protect your customers?
So the first thing we do is actually we detect port scanners already on our edge. We have basically two kinds of customers, right? We have the normal users, which we actually handle security kind of for them, right? Because we know they will never need inbound anything, really.
So are these going to be like home users?
Yeah, exactly. Those would be like your standard home users. And of course, those would be behind NAT and not have a public address, right? So what we actually do is for them, we already block all the port scanners at our edge. And those port scanners, which even try to get into any of our, you know, segments which are protected this way, are actually blocked already on our edge. And of course, all devices. So like you are saying, you know, block HTTP, HTTPS, or TCP, AT, TCP 443. Normally, you would want to do it the other way, right? Block everything and only allow things which you want from the IP address ranges which you want. So that's what we actually do. All other devices just drop everything by default and then only accept, you know, management traffic from our specified management subnet and our VPN management subnet. And that's much, you know, a much better security practice, and it's also a best security, you know, best practice, which is used everywhere. Drop everything and only allow the things that you want from the sources that you want.
Okay.
So that's what we do everywhere.
How about your, say, your quote-unquote business class customers? They're going to end up with the public.
Yeah, the usually it depends on what the customer wants, right? Because usually when they know and they specifically ask for a public IP address, we just hand them a public IP address, and that's the demarcation point, and their router, their device is their responsibility. So our CPEs are just bridges, and they, you know, the customers then just dial a PPPoE session, which gives a public IP address to their router, and it's their responsibility, right? So our bridges are, of course, completely separated because the management is in a different VLAN. So what we actually do is we deliver, basically have a separate VLAN for PPPoE for all our customers that has no management, no IP addresses, no nothing. It's just a straight bridge to the nearest router, which bridges it to a VPLS tunnel and then all the way to our core, to our PPPoE access concentrator, right? So those customers, they don't even know they have a CPE there, because to them it's completely transparent. It doesn't have an IP address on their VLAN, etc. And then the CPE has a separate VLAN inside of which it has a routed IP address, but again there is a full firewall there even like that. So that's how we handle it, by total separation of management traffic into a separate VLAN from customer PPPoE sessions in another VLAN.
Nice. Alright, Miller, what do you do to kind of protect your MDUs, your home customers, those sorts of guys?
Well, Thomas covered just about everything there. I mean, you keep everything separate. You know, my radios are not accessible from the public internet because they're on private IPs. So everything's NATed for the most part.
Gotcha. Do you guys use any Ubiquity CPEs inside your network?
No chance.
Okay, just curious. And I think, do I have any Ubiquiti stuff? I've got a couple of bridges and an access point, I think, but that's about it. And I know Miller, you're doing maybe an air fiber or two here or there. But again, you have those so locked down that they're not really customer accessible in any shape, form, or fashion. So I guess it kind of removes all that from the equation anyway. How about you, Mike? What are you doing as your best practice on the outside? Anything different than what these guys are doing?
One fault that I've found with the Ubiquiti firewall on the CPE is that they don't differentiate the input chain from the forward chain. And so, like, I can't drop traffic destined to the box. It just seems like if it's on this port, it just goes on through. So, like, if I'm NATing, then I can't drop everything because then something else could come through. Or if they establish a port forward, then I'm blocking that. So I haven't gone that far on any of that stuff. I do network-wide, you know, block 53 from anywhere other than my DNS servers. I block NTP. I block, you know, anything against amplification attacks. I block spoofing so that any particular subnet or, you know, tower, all that can leave from that tower is things that are supposed to leave from that tower. So that way my customers can't spoof anything. There's a lot more I want to do and I need to do. There's fires.
Gotcha.
Bigger fires elsewhere.
And that brings up a good point, Mike, is one thing is, you know, protecting your customers from the outside. But once they do get infected, how do you protect everybody else from them? You know, say they do get infected with something and it's trying to do an amplification attack or they become part of a botnet or something like that. You know, how do you protect from that sort of thing? And I guess aside from save for doing some kind of intrusion prevention, some intrusion detection, I don't know that you, well, other than your clients pumping out a tremendous amount of unexpected bandwidth, I guess, how do you anticipate or how do you plan for that?
Yet, I do know that much larger networks do something. I know that a couple months ago, Comcast, maybe been this past winter, Comcast was going around and actually shutting off connections to people that were participating in DNS amplification attacks. I've got that all set up and everything on my network. Well, I had a microtik at Kate's house and I had forgotten to block that on hers. And so then it got shut off and I went to the Comcast support chat through my phone and they turned it back on. 2 days later, it got shut off again. So I went back there, turned it back on. But by this point, I'd seen a discussion on Nanog about Comcast doing, you know, shutting things off. And so then I was like, wait a minute, let's check Torch. And sure, I checked Torch and I saw that I had 15 megabit of outbound DNS. And I'm like, I shouldn't have that. I shouldn't have this when there's only 4 devices in the house.
Yeah.
Well, 14 maybe. But so then that's when I realized what it was and stopped that. You know, I would assume that their, you know, flow monitoring tools would have, you know, caught that sort of thing. You know, there's a whole array of flow monitoring things out there. The newest and coolest one I've seen is Kentix, but that will show you a million things about your data and where it's going and whatnot.
And I think very soon we're going to do a cast on DDoS mitigation, probably including trigger black holes, some of the flow spec stuff, IP fix, how you get all that stuff into a collector, what the different collectors look like, some closed source, some open source that are paid, and what they can do on your network. And I've actually kind of been kicking around the idea of a script sort of thing. There was another Thomas, a guy from, I think he was from Denmark, was talking about how he was using that flow collector, looking for surges in traffic, and then he was having it execute a script where it would go to his microticks and add firewall rules. And I was thinking, that doesn't sound like it would be too tremendously difficult. So I was thinking about trying to implement something like that, only open it up so that people far better than me can actually improve it and make it work the way it's supposed to. So I guess we'll kind of wrap that one all into that. Any other closing words? We're trying to make this one of the mini casts, right? And so we're trying to keep it right around the 30-minute mark. Any other contributions you guys have to this specific topic, basic security?
Ella, one thing that I kept seeing on the Ubiquiti threads and discussions was people saying that I don't have to worry at all because of private IPs or because of NAT. You know, I know that Justin was, well, it's the weekend, they're all private IPs, they're all NAT, I can wait till Monday to look at it. And that's fine. But the people that were, I don't have to worry about it at all. My thought was, right now it's being delivered by, you know, just scanning the internet. What's to say that they don't deliver it through a Flash vulnerability or a Java vulnerability, infect your PC or your Blu-ray player or whatever it is that is the, you know, vulnerability of the week, and then they scan from inside out.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Or somebody decides to start delivering this through an existing botnet that happens to be on the one of those people happens to be on the inside of your network.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, don't always assume that once it's the evil internet that's bad, and that everything once it passes my border is fine. You have to lock down everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I end up working with a lot of different enterprise people. And one of the things one of the larger organizations told me is they said, and this guy may just be a little bit more on the doom and gloom conspiracy theory side, but he said, you're already infected. Your information's already being stolen. You just got to find out where it's going and shut it down, right? And so his idea is pretend like it already is, because, you know, at some point it will be. You know, somebody will get infected inside and they'll start sending information out, right? And this is an enterprise guy. So he's saying you need to put intrusion detection watching outbound traffic. I think Alex probably has a little bit of that paranoia, but, you know, that's what he's paid for. So he'd probably be a really good one to talk to on this topic as well. So next time we'll have to suck him in on that. I think he would be a good resource for that as well.
One more thing. So I listed earlier the firmware versions that were fine from this vulnerability that's currently being exploited. There are other vulnerabilities that they've already patched and released firmware. So if you just went to 5.6.2 or 5.5.11 thinking you're going to be okay, there's other ones out there that they've already patched in 5.6.3, 5.6.4. I think there was another one in 5.6.6 that they patched. So you're not clear just because you went to 5.6.2. To Greg's point earlier about, you know, once you find one that's safe, you stick with it. You should always, you know, I generally wait a month or two past when a firmware release hits public to wait for any major problems to be discovered and, you know, potentially pulled back. That's happened before. Then take that firmware, start testing it in a limited scope, figure out why it doesn't work in your environment and if it doesn't, and work on getting those bugs fixed, because that is far more important that you, they're not going to backport that vulnerability fix to your holy grail firmware, but they will fix your problem in the future. So, you know, work on that.
Awesome. Awesome. Any closing words, Miller?
I guess Comcast doesn't block 53 to its residents.
That's pretty crazy, or at least they didn't for a while.
They should. It should be something they block.
Absolutely. So. How about you, Thomas? I know I don't need to tell you the dangers of using Ubiquiti stuff. You already come to that conclusion yourself. But as far as having their stuff together, I think you're one of the more solid guys. So I think you're here just to look down on everybody. But any closing words on this topic?
I mean, honestly, my approach to all of this is a little bit different, because we mentioned a bunch of stuff here, like you should be constantly upgrading, you should be, monitoring all your inbound, outbound, and protecting your customers and everything else. I have a bit of a different approach, because, like I said, for your basic customers, there is no need for them to have a public IP address of any kind, directly assigned or netted or anything. They don't need it, right? So those should be completely blocked off by default from anything incoming to them, right? And if we are talking about an attack from an inside, right, then again, if everything is dropped, you know, being already blocked, other than your management subnets for your management, then that is not an issue either. So, like, we mentioned tons of stuff which basic firewalling and basic, very well-known security practices completely solve, right? If you only had proper firewalling on your devices, this would never have happened. So have proper firewalling. I mean, it's as simple as that, right? If you had that, then this wouldn't be an issue.
Yeah. I think, or at least this is what I've seen a lot of times, is networks will start up, right? And it'll be a guy shooting to his grain silo and then hitting his house, and then it'll grow from there. And it's this organic growth. And he was never necessarily a network guy to begin with or anything like that. And then, eventually his network's so big.
I know exactly what you mean. I think this is a very big problem, actually. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that once it gets so big, people get afraid to touch it, right? Because it's working, and if I touch it, it's going to break. And so it gets really difficult for those guys to...
But, yeah, it doesn't work that way. I mean, if you have a really big network, you need to be good at networking. It's like, imagine if you were building cars for thousands of people and you didn't know how cars work, right? It just doesn't work that way. If you want to build big networks, if you want to operate big networks, you either have to learn all the stuff properly and do it properly, or hire somebody to do that for you. I mean, I'm sorry, but I am very, very bitter about people that do things they don't know how to do, and people that don't do stuff properly, and it's how it's supposed to be done. I mean, we had exactly the same thing here, only 20 miles from me, a huge operator, same about 3,500 customers, right? They went down for 3 days because of this Ubiquiti bug. And it's totally crazy to me. How can you be a ISP of 3,500 customers and not have basic security practices like this?
It's the American way, Thomas.
No, it's completely wrong, and you should fix it. It's as simple as that.
I was talking with Justin Wilson about this because I know that he has lots of clients that have Ubiquiti. There's three options. There's learn it and do it yourself, hire someone else to do it, or be ready to face the consequences. If you're not willing to learn and you're not able or willing to pay somebody, then you have to be able to take it on the chin.
Yeah.
Exactly.
A piece of advice somebody gave me a long time ago is they said, do the things you're really good at, and everything else, find somebody to do it for a good price. So, and that's actually, I've taken that to heart, because if you're trying to force yourself to be this network guy, you're going to be lazy about it. You're going to hate every minute of it, and you're never going to do it as good as somebody else could, that you could oftentimes easily pay. You could affordably pay to have somebody help you out. So don't overlook the simple things sometimes. So guys, I think we're nearing the 35-minute mark, so we pretty much hit the target. So I'm going to go ahead and kill the recording on this one. And thank you, everybody, for popping in, all the Facebook guys that continue to read Mike's rants. Appreciate you guys stomaching his personality. And be sure to keep adding comments and questions up there. This one, since it was so heavily active on the Brothers Wisp, this one, we did just kind of a little mini cast about it. Anything else you guys are interested in, let us know.